Blog Talk Radio.
Episode of Masonic Effects. It's an absolute pleasure to have you sitting in with us today, and it's special for me for us around here for a lot of reasons. This is the first time we have people sitting in with us from a couple of countries that have never done that before. So a little shout out to you, you know, as I occasionally do in my maudlin way, to Australia. You've been with us for so very long, and I deeply appreciate that. It means just that, if nothing else, for the connection. And whoever you are, you put a pin in the map for me, for us, knowing that masonry in Australia is taken quite seriously and treated with a tremendous amount of respect. And so, the shout-out, though, Australia, Iran, yeah, and Turkey, Netherlands, Germany, the UK, Spain, USA, and Canada. Welcome. Welcome, and sit back for be entertained, be informed, be what you are, relax with us for a very short period of time. And from the onset, Masonic Effects was always an indulgence, and one that I thought and was encouraged to share with the world, the notion not that I'm going to impose anything anywhere, but to connect, that there would be like-minded people. And so As you know, as regular listeners know, we explore the world in a context suitable to the aspirations of masonry, but in terms of the way that I translate, just like each of you, the form of masonry in your mind, that conversation that's going on is so unique. And so I'm always curious and wanting that connectivity. And sometimes I fluctuate and I like the affirmation. And at other times it's like, it raises the question. It raises an important question. Do I have a sense of this? Do I know within myself that certain things are? In other words, am I basing my life on faith and beliefs, or do I have anything factual to fall back on? Not that faith and beliefs are to be dismissed. I don't even know if you can do that. But that some things are important and deserve to be elevated to that level of respect. Being true, being truthful to myself over the years has become more understandable. And it's not understanding the meaning, it's understanding the effect. the application, if you want. Today we have we settle into some observations. The whole program is essentially a series of observations, starting from the commentary, my observations, and that changes week by week by week. Observations of a poet. That's I like to think the big little understanding of the world, or the little big, you know, the macro and the micro, people that are able to connect with the emotion and intellect in a way that is familiar when it's drawn out. Once it's said, we can all relax and notice, ah, now I see, now I understand. It's like maths. You know them, but to have them presented is wonderful. It's like, oh, there. Even as you're learning, and much of learning is like that. It's like, oh, yeah, now I see there's a logic. There's something familiar in it. And when you put things together in certain order, ideas together in certain order, it becomes understandable because it's connected. It's not just standalone information, but it connects in this beautiful, beautiful matrix we have developed consciousness, or that we have consciousness, or we discovered it or produced it. It's the magic, my goodness. It's when I use that term in a Masonic sense, oh yes, are you wondering, do we erase any reference to esoteric or occult? Absolutely not. That it takes a boldness to do that, I find, because it's usually those conversations amount to a lot of silliness, a lot of bravado, and not the gravitas, not the seriousness that I appreciate. It's always followed me, and I think many people, when you get through the silliness, you can have a night out with your mates, and it's quite wonderful. We're carousing and carrying on, but there are also people known to me and you that will deceive the world, not want them to know too much about the conversation. So it's easy, you'll find, it's easy to encourage people to mock you or to belittle your idea if you're looking for a way to disguise your activity. It's quite simple. Oh, just a bunch of old, silly old fools. Nothing really serious going on. Old schoolmates, nothing really serious going on. It's a ploy that's been used many, many times by serious thinkers. I like to think of it as like a ploy that you see at the chessboard. It becomes a ploy when you understand it, and it also becomes useful if you have a sense of privacy that you want to maintain. Nothing to see here. Go over there. I was raised in a materialist world, and it didn't work for me. It didn't work because it always had this sense of the something more, is that all there is kind of thinking. Not that the growth and accomplishments of people around me aren't of any less value, because they certainly are, you know. The historic perspective provides a different context, as the poetry provides a different context, as the commentary. But what do you say about the mathematics and the music? I need something to tie it all together. Well, I couldn't begin to try and satisfy taste. So in a way, I'm in a very small way, I think, I'm encouraging tolerance and exploration. You listen to what somebody like me prefers. What's his taste like? And I often wonder, ladies and gentlemen, you can tell me this and comment on this. It occurred to me a couple of weeks ago that we often aren't emphasizing the gravitas, the seriousness of Masonry from the start. And it seems that for a lot of people, they discover the nature of Masonry within the first couple of years. And without that being structured in any way or acknowledged, it can lead to, because you have the reality and this idealism, chafing one against the other. And I thought that perhaps the holdback on that is because we're people that don't have enough information to be able to confidently articulate those ideas. And I thought, there's something not quite there. There's something there, but there's a presence that I need that rings hollow when I talk about the lack of knowledge, because you can explore, and I've met a lot of very knowledgeable people. And then it struck me, and I share this with you for your advice and your consideration, that the communication of the nature of our order is best done symbolically. Oh, I don't mean the brand. There are a lot of lodges who jumped on that. No, I don't mean that. Although I find that curious that people would care about maintaining some legal control. So, feet of clay in a way. If you were walking with me, and I opened the door to this building, and I needed you to have a better sense of me, I would, if you wanted a better sense of me without any words being exchanged, I would give you a reading list. And then I would exchange that with you. Give me your book list of the five or ten books that have been most influential. Now, immediately you jump up and say, hey, do you mean in a Masonic sense? Well, I don't know if the world is any different because of the bias that we bring forward. No, I don't mean in any particular sense. You determine that. You determine what's important, because those, as I read through those book titles, that alone will tell me something about the person that I'm dealing with, without words. Imagine then if you could do that with a lodge room, to speak for you and about you in ways that you can't, and to speak about us in ways that you might not, for the benefit of expanding the understanding of a person that has a fresh set of eyes. What would you put in there? What art? Yeah, art immediately comes to mind. Color, sound, smell. Would it be, and here I'm going to just wax nostalgically, would it be the creak and smell of old leather chairs? Would it be the wall with busts of Newton and Plato and Shakespeare and Mozart? Would it be runes? Would it be ancient symbols? Would it be the quotes, a quote over the door? Ah, a man should exceed his grasp, or what's the heaven for? Or know thyself, or Gaviademtor. And when I walk through, is there a motif? Is it an Anglo-Saxon motif? Is it a Druidic motif? How would you even begin to do that? A big group dust up, a big argument? Don't be absurd. And so these, when we see that, when those aren't there, we are holding back information by omission, I would claim. And why? Because we haven't thought about it. We haven't thought it through. When you see lodges like that, and I'm sure you have, in North America particularly, in Canada, in Ontario, where I am, we often see that. It's understated, constantly understated, because those elements are reflection. Those doing that is a reflection of an intellect, of an understanding, and you can say the words out loud. Don't have to be embarrassed about things like that. Would you, if you're looking at the mansion of a poet, would you have the periodic table? Would you have the Fibonacci numbers? Would you have samples of fractal geometry or Euclidean geometry? You know, each to his or her own. But you think about the things that you, the artifacts, the things that are scaled to that do, whether intentionally or not, leave an impression. Sounds. Doing that also is a reflection of thoughtfulness. You know, you may be consumed by what's right in front of you. You may be conscious of some sort. But there will be that moment when you're not. Maybe you feel, you walk into situations feeling like you're a bird in a cage. Yeah. And here, the bird in the cage looks through and sees. Now, if you slow the mind down a little bit and begin to observe, a la the instruction of the poet, begin to notice, is this a room that was designed? Is there an intent here? Is it a casual confidence? Is it somebody being thoughtful? It's like when you sit down somewhere and a person offers you a glass of water or a cup of tea or a glass of wine or cappuccino or whatever. It's a kindness. I learned that long, long ago, that when somebody extends an offer of help to you, you always acknowledge and, if at all possible, accept it. I was raised not to do those things. I taught that, very, very much, very clearly. So to unlearn that is interesting, to relearn. It's important because it makes people that make an offer feel good. But today, this program will be about those kind of observations, about the things we know and the things we ought to know, the things we do and the things we want to be. And I think you'll find it rewarding. One of those things that's been gnawing away at my conscience for far too long has to do with wrongness and the worldview. And it raises a question. If I am an ethical man, how do I know myself to be so? If a person does something that it wrongs me in some way or hurts me in some way, because I Is that justification for retaliation in kind? What if I am aware of that process and instead of, you know, eye for an eye, you slight me, I slight you, that I reserve that judgment and instead examine inwardly what's happening, what has happened, and then the range of responses, how I communicate this feeling and whether I communicate it. If somebody is doing me wrong, how do I communicate at their level or at level that I think is best for me? Do I maintain a position out of a sense of integrity, even though I'll likely be mocked? Which is the more Masonic flavor? You know, you can extrapolate and you can piece this together all on your own. Not to do with me, I don't think. It's the idea. When I look at this, I fight and quarrel with ritual. Oh my goodness. I begin with the notion, an instruction, and I'll pass this on to you for your own consideration. It's, ritual is to be read with an inquiring mind. Otherwise, it's lifeless. It's can be tedious. It becomes the way that the prevalent, the predominant way that this has been described and where I've been practicing masonry is that it's memory work. Sorry, as an oil change. Michelangelo's work as covering up that stain in the wallpaper. I don't think about anything more odd. I don't even think little boys by that. You know, I don't, you know, how old do you have to be? 8 years old? We want you to learn this poet, party, this, we're going to gather all the parents together. We'll have pageantry and costume and songs. And we want you we're going to put you together as a choir. And we begin that whole process with music because it's familiar and it's easy and it's melodic. And a lot of that is traditions that define us as people, as tribes. And we went through all of those battles. We didn't have to, really. We went through, you know, policy. We uncover not, we don't have the of puppets, the bureaucracies of bureaucracy. And the other part of it is it's like they're in where I am, we deal with consequences. I know it's already, and we do without necessarily thinking that the world is going to jump on this and leave a pair of old as they've worn out and pick this new pair. No, maybe just send a hern in the air. And there are color people with that culture wherever you might be on the planet. The mindset connects, that collective consciousness that Carl Jung was talking about is brought to mind. And we have, we read the inquiry And I'm specific about it because it's helpful. It's a helpful thought. Not to say, you know, you think about it, walking around with a firing mind, it's like, if you're that hard, we make it very hard by thinking that it's hard. It's impossible. So we are self-defeating in so many ways. Well, once you know that, I don't mean hear it, but know it, it still leaves the matter of what to do. What to do and how to act and how to know that you can trust your judgment not to be self-loathing and undermining, and self-critical and doubtful. How do you do that? You cover it up with arrogance, false confidence, you know. Nah, you can, but it doesn't work. It falls apart. Oh, don't ever think that somebody is happy because they've got a big bank account. No, it doesn't. The lesson you were taught a long time ago that you can't buy happiness. You can buy a full belly of food. You can buy warmth. You can buy shelter, but happiness, that comes from within. That's the energy of the world around us. So I'm not going to get into, although I would love to, I'm not going to get into the search for the life force that comes to us from ritual. We'll get into that later when I can be a lot more familiar and useful to you. Today we're going to sit back and share some ideas. I think you'll like the "if there's clamor, it must be brethren having a good time." keep in mind that as we go through this, that notion that just because somebody, triggers, is irritating, in Masonic terms, is it proper to respond in kind? Or is that an opportunity for you to demonstrate that you are a mentor, that you can look at the world as a classroom, and you can look at the sense of irritation as the entered apprentice learning, creating opportunity to be taught? Or you can pick up your belt or your stick and just wail away, or do that with your words. That's all too common, especially when two boys that have been raised, abused, are at it with each other. Who weighs in on that? There's always confidence. Here, I want you to enjoy. So we'll begin with the music portion of the show with a little something from Cannonball Adderley. This is called "Nancy with the Laughing Face." Ho ho! It is soothing, isn't it? Yeah. A commentary. My contribution to observations. For your consideration. And I know you'll have your own. I would certainly hope so. If there's a clamor, it must be brethren having a good time. We are a clamorous lot. I like that. I like that. I don't think I would do well if we were all marshaled into careful lines and taught to keep in our lane. Nah. What would be the point of that? Don't despair. Masonry has always been cloaked in mystery. But if you want to know the truth, watch the behavior of a man. It will reveal all his secrets, all his doubts, his honesty or deceptions. Inside is where men step on stage to join or not join in the production of harmony. If you have a capacity for compromise and coordinate your actions with those of others on the same page, you will still find Masonry elevating. When we rehearse, we reveal who has or has not put in the hours. We see you having talent, and we see who has talent and who is journeyman, who is working, who is the soloist and who is the chorus. If the troupe is confident at the onset about their mutual vulnerability, they will experience that evasive compatibility. In our case, the arts and sciences prompt and remind as well as define. We are entry-level learners of a company with headliners. Learning to be at ease with our traditions takes some time. Some are completely satisfied with manners, even if they have missed the point. It's ironic manners that ease social awkwardness are taught with a switch and a sharp tongue. Instead, this troupe does it casually, brother to brother, sister to sister, and we pick up on them to assure we stay in character. Do old men act like old men? Inescapably, we can bristle at the slightest perceived disagreements. Why, we can even invent them to ensure we stay in the comfort zone. In the audience, looking up at performers who have honed their talents. If we didn't have an audience, we wouldn't have a performance. So we do what's familiar. We react. What I'm saying here is that we react as we always have until, not that we're threatened or challenged or embarrassed or humiliated, but until we are taught, we are drawn out. The more of us, the depth of us is drawn out. If you believe that conflict is necessary in your life, then by all means, if you believe that being supreme, being first, defining the agenda is your prerogative, then by all means. But as you sit back, you'll see accomplishments by people who have those qualities. And all you can do is watch from the outside looking in. This isn't the wrongness of your life. This is the option. This is a building. Do you see yourself as a single remote mind, a remote consciousness in a universe of hundreds of billions of galaxies? That's it? bit lonely, no? Because you're guessing. You're guessing. That kind of drive, what? If you're old enough and do it long enough, we can. You can earn the characteristic misanthrope who wants to be around you. My gosh, who can? Who can tolerate that? Except somebody that you can suppress, I guess. You always find somebody that you can for their own reasons. They can sublimate their own thoughts and dreams for whatever reason. Yeah. Abused women have been doing that for millennia. We aren't here to talk about self-sacrifice, but awareness. That clamorous nature has to do with the crowd. That's the new boys. You may go on for decades and never graduate. It's your prerogative. If you are a clamorous type, then keep, by all means, you don't need my permission to do it. But if you're wondering about the nature of masonry, hold yourself to accounts. Look at the consequence of what you're doing on the people around you. In order to build yourself up, you need to push people away or act as if there is a rightness to opinion. You have one. That's it. Foolishness. No pun intended. You're going to hear this next tune. Michelle Petrucciani and sitting in with Stefan Grappelli. These foolish things. Yeah. Thank you. Lovely. This is the portion of the program where we listen to the lyrics without the music behind it. Poetry. It holds a special place in our lives when we are able to give ourselves permission to enjoy the work of the librettist, the lyrics of the tune. Stop putting so much distance between yourself and poetry. It's around every day. Many of us don't get into our car without turning on the radio and listening, or waking up in the morning to remember those delightful clocks that would come on when they first came on automatically, and music would be playing your alarm instead of an alarm. Do you remember those? And the little numbers that would the little half flip, it would be just click over and over on this wheel. 601 would become 602, would become 6. I absolutely love that. What a brilliant idea. And now it just flashes away. There's no sound. I can flash it anywhere at the time. This is maybe it opens up. I think it tends to open us up directly and indirectly to an appreciation of ourselves. Not just the words and the thinking behind them and the meaning of all of that, but certainly appreciate the fact that you are, in spite of yourself, you are a poet at heart. That there is that you're as this lovely man just pointed out to me in discussion earlier this week. It's about inflection. It's the emphasis. What word when we're reading, going through life, what do we put the emphasis on? Because it changes the meaning, doesn't it? The sound of our voice, our expression, the nonverbals, these express emotion, and it's emotion that gives words meaning. Because it provides the context. I'll kill you if you're in a dark alley with somebody very large and menacing, and that can be life-altering in itself. If it's that huge giant of a grandfather chasing his little grandsons around the barnyard while he's clambering along, roaring out these notions, I'll kill you, boy, I'll kill you, little rascals. He never, always just behind, but never quite able to catch up. You know, you're always just that little bit faster than Grampy. You're just until the grandmother and the mothers come running out, and then the cousins and I all scatter in different directions, screaming and laughing and having a great time because we know he can't get us. He can't get us. Look what he did for us. Such a lovely old dad. The emphasis, the context. What did he mean? He loved us. He protected us. Nothing could harm us. Robert Browning, outrageous, yeah, the guy, a interesting man, and check it out and Google him if you want to learn more about the guy, go ahead, or you may already know, this is a guy that was born in 1812, around the time is a bit significant to Canadians, because we had a big battle going on, 1812, quite pivotal, but he had parents who were quite intelligent people. His dad was a banker, an intellectual. Yeah, his library had around 6,000 volumes, but he was born into a business. His father had slave-run plantations in the West Indies. But Browning's father rejected that and became spent his life as an abolitionist in London. And it was rumored that Browning's Jamaican grandmother was a mulatto. Parentings. Remember that? And Browning's mother was a musician. So he was a precociously intelligent kid who had written his first book of poetry by the age of 12. He was fluent in several languages by the age of 14. And in addition to that, he composed music. So as a course in life, he dedicated himself to writing poetry. But it wasn't for the fame. He was not well known. It was in 1845, he sent a letter to the poet Elizabeth Barrett praising her work. Oh, she was a poet too. And one thing led to another, and they began a secret courtship. Barrett was an invalid and confined to her home by her illness and her strict father. So, but in 1846, the two eloped and left for Italy. And there, Browning, you could imagine Elizabeth Barrett Browning, oof, read her work. Oh, this is the release of the human spirit, yeah? In Italy, Browning began to work on poetry that would gain him renown. Almost, you know, keeping up with his more famous wife. And then after her death in 1861, he came back to England. And that's when his poetry really took off. He gained a reputation. He wrote this book-length epic poem, The Ring and the Book. 1868 it was published. And it's based on a Roman murder case dating in the 1690s. The book is composed of lengthy poems and different characters of the study. Can you imagine? Unconventional structure, just... You had to have it. You had to read it. You had to, you know, if you're going to be in that group, you, of course. And what did it mean? It wasn't that. It was, what did it mean to you? What did it mean? We're going to pick this up again sometime. Just the man is just a joy. In this short poem, Meeting at Night, we explore something that, if you're salacious by nature, it has those qualities. If you're curious, if you're seeing the resilience of love, young love, it's in there, all the charm. Or if you want to look at the frivolity of life, if you're family, you're a member of the Capulets, oh, fine, you know, it is what it is, all unnecessary. It's all about business and the coldness of politics. This is Meeting at Night. This is when the speaker is, the person who's giving us this narrative here, describes a landscape, dull sea and an expanse of land and it's very black, you know. There's a half moon he's talking about and small waves. And the speaker rows into the bay and brings a vessel to halt in wet sand, you know, scrapes up and then walks for a mile along the warm beach. And you can smell this, you know, when you're walking along, it's delightful. The speaker continues across three fields until he reaches a farm and then knocks on a window. And somebody else, implied to be the speaker's lover, hurriedly strikes a match and it bursts into that blue flame. And then we hear the voice, overcome with happiness and fear, you know, don't be hurt. The voice doesn't seem to be as loud, but the hearts, you know, So this poem on love and perseverance, all that. Who wants to be reminded of such things except people who realize that the beautiful things, the beautiful experiences are written in the, on their hearts forever. It aims to, this poem aims to capture the vitality and excitement of romantic love. It lingers, especially when it's the early stages of something that blossoms. Better to have loved than lost than ever to have loved at all. Yeah. So this guy, Browning, was writing this while he was courting his soon-to-be wife, Elizabeth Barrett. And we know Barrett's dad did not like it. Nope, stay away. She's an invalid. She's the girl. She stays at home. Which meant, of course, you're going to elope, run away, and live in Italy. Here. And why not? Their dad, it's all unnecessary. Why would you put that gap between your daughter who loves this young man and you? Why would you do that? So keep that in mind as you read. This is a couple of lines here. The gray sea and long black land and the yellow half moon, large and low, and the startled little waves that leap in fiery ringlets from their sleep. And as I gain the cove with pushing prow and quench its speed in the slushy sand, then a mile of warm sea-scented beach, three fields to cross till a farm appears, a tap on the pane, that quick, sharp scratch, and the blue spurt of a lighted match, and a voice less loud through its joys and fears than the two hearts beating each to each. Get it? You have your own version of that. Now think, if you're thinking that your own background was only mediocrity and very pedestrian, think of it as you in search of the higher qualities of the poetic nature of life, your life, and now describe it. And if it's hard, it is hard. It's confusing. Let this poet help us. Let Browning help us. And maybe forever and always, Browning's words will be how you define your love in life. That moment when you were just overcome with the confusion and the intensity of loving somebody. Yeah, Django. Thank you. Django Reinhardt. I'm going to share with you a piece of history. Again, still plowing through Margaret J. Jacobs' work, Living the Enlightenment. All that reference to us. And this portion, I think, beautifully illustrates something about commitment and ability. It begins with some threats, a cousin to her male cousin. When the dominies start, they will not stop for a long time. They will play a dirty game and they will ruin you if they find out that you're a Mason. Watch out. They will try to prevent you from getting a lawyer to write something for you, and they will attack you and them too. What to do then? And try to get close to the gentlemen, that is, to the members of the local municipal government. In supplicating her Nemagen cousin to leave the Freemasons, our anonymous writer then adds, from where I sit and write, I would also like to become one, but if it were evil, but the women do not have a place in this, and I rethink the matter, it would be no good that someone else should hear this, for surely the Domini would visit me, and that would be the end of me. Places where women could not go or were not welcome were hardly new. From the tone of the discussion, what most disturbs the woman is that the Masonic Lodge is profoundly different from anything else around it. Yet clearly, her cousin is deeply committed enough to the fraternity that he was prepared to risk his reputation and to stand up to the local minister. We know this resolve from the petitions the Merks brothers went on to file with the local secular authorities. They appealed to the Assembly of Regents, who were an authority separate from the consistory of the Calvinist Church, and in theory more powerful than it, but only in purely secular matters. Clearly, the Merks brothers were not about to take a rejection at the hands of the Dominies Bruin and Haverkamp. The magistrates seemed favorably disposed, but the ministers opposed the petition. Eventually, the stalemate was resolved only when the Merks brothers found another minister from outside of Nijmegen who admitted them to the Reformed Church. They also went on to become officers of the Nijmegen Lodge, but the damage had been done, and the incident had become news all over the Republic. We need now to explore what it was that so compelled the Nijmegen Freemasons that they were prepared to challenge the local clergy and to provoke the concomitant concern of their family. As we have seen, membership in the first and recently opened lodge in Nijmegen could result in scorn and insult on a scale and of a specifically religious kind that was probably not as likely or at least as serious as the much larger city of Amsterdam or where in Paris, or certainly in Paris in that period. Yet in those places, the lodges were also controversial. We can infer the charges leveled against the Dutch lodges from the defenses published at the time by Freemasons in Nijmegen and Amsterdam. They reveal a great deal about the intellectual posture that the fraternity could assume in its new cultural setting and also its relationship to contemporary Dutch culture. The Masonic defenses of 1750 will also eventually bring us back to the origins of continental Freemasonry, to the problem of exactly how, why, and by whom Freemasonry was transmitted to the Dutch Republic, and what else besides its rules and rituals came with it. But that question of origins must continue to wait until we have explored the posture taken by this new society in the Republic, until we have tried to determine exactly what has been imported. Really, talking about conviction, what does this tell us? It reveals that intelligent minds will have a sense of self-control in dealing with these pressures. It also suggests that people less well-equipped, with less ability, will struggle. And we see that around us. You know, this is being played out again. Played out again. Stay in your lane. Huh? Dear. Dear, dear. It's our history. We draw to a close again, sadly. We've survived the pressure points in the 18th century Netherlands. The intensity of young love, to overcome, to prevail. You know, the parallels are there. If you want it badly enough, can you hold your confidence, your own counsel close to your breast? And is there enough of a draw to push back against the authority? And can you do that for all the right reasons, for noble reasons, maintaining integrity? Even the commentary today, we get together, there's clamor. I hope you don't take away that I mean that it should be bitter and unpleasant and ill-mannered. No, never that. This is that conversation that you've had where you lean in, and it's interesting. Where it's not scripted, that it has a sense. And it's like what happens when a group of people that have some degree of modesty and intelligence come together. You'll get around to talking about the point without having it prescribed, without somebody scripting it. I find that very tedious, always have. But if you're coming to talk about something meaningful, say that, put it out there. Then how you get there, well, you ease into it, don't you? Or it becomes more extemporaneous or spontaneous. Or, like here, it flows. And it flows on purpose. There's a fluidity to masonry. Always has been. The conversation that we're having was started hundreds and hundreds of years ago at a different level. And no, if you're insulting, if you think that I have some kind of veiled insult here, no. I'm not one that subscribes to the idea that we put a monkey in a typewriter in a room and leave him long enough and he'll bang out Shakespeare. Come on. You know, You have to buy me another round in the student pub to get away with that kind of debate. But no, we're a little bit further down the road in so many ways. Thank you for sitting in. I hope it's been entertaining and useful to you. As you take on a sense of the different levels of charity outlined for us, thank goodness, by my enemies. Please include yourself in that. Think of where I am, we're coming up to a season where cold feels a little harsher, when you can't participate in all of the privileges of a materialist world. There's a lot of people, the majority of people are like that. I live in a country that's supposed to be so well developed. It is a developed country, and we have so many privileges, but 1 in 5 are hungry. And our politics isn't enough. This is a task that we have to undertake ourselves to make sure people are safe. Do that. And include yourself in that. Be as generous as you possibly can in your daily life. And I look forward to seeing you again next week on Masonic Effects. Thanks.